This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to a new edition of Screen Talk. Ladies and gentlemen, we've started the show again a couple of weeks ago and we have yet to have a member of the family in the show. But he is here and it has brought a warm glow into the room. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome James Gill back into the studio. That's just one single clap.
I'm going to join in.
I really need to learn your MC skills, don't I? Because that didn't create... You are so good at MCing, can I just say. We did a charity gig a couple of weeks ago. You really know how to just get a room going, don't you?
May I just say, if we're going to do this mutual ball wash, that before that gig, you were terrified and you didn't want to do it. And then lo and behold, he was... Dan was so awesome.
Oh, stop it.
But Dan's worry was that the gig was going to go so well that it might lure him back into comedy.
Yeah.
A bit like, you know, that sweet, sweet last kick of heroin.
Yeah, and it was.
And I want to put it to you, you must be coming back to comedy now.
I am definitely thinking about it, yes.
Yes.
Oh, I haven't replied to your message.
No, you haven't.
No, I will do I can't do that night, but I will do a new material night.
Beautiful.
So there you go. Let's crack straight on to today's subject. James, you and I have been biting our tongue. Well, you less so about our opinions on this list that was released yesterday, I believe.
Yes.
This was the BBC asked 250 critics.
If you've seen The Great Escape, you'll know the bit I mean where Steve McQueen goes, 250? And that was kind of my reaction when I saw this.
250 film critics.
Yes. From around the world.
Really, they mean America and England, probably, and Britain.
Well, given the way Jerry Lewis figures, I imagine there are quite a few French, because Jerry Lewis, God rest his incredibly talented soul, was like almost a god in France. So he was huge in America, but in France, the guy was revered as something like profound and special.
The French love rubber-faced comedians,
they
don't
really
they?
Do. They
don't
love
it. Do you know, my show is big in France, and I'm like, am I doing...
Yes,
I am quite physical.
You are.
But
I think you're more of a physical comedian than you realise.
Than I want to be.
I love physical comedy. Your facial expressions, the physicality, it's wonderful.
God, we're really loving each other today, aren't we? But so they released the 100 greatest comedy films ever, according to these 250 critics, which is a lot, actually. Because normally, like, when people put a list together, it's not that many, but 250, that is a lot of people. And you and I are quite shocked by a lot of these lists.
I think I'm going through the different stages of grief.
You are a bit, because you were angry earlier, that's for sure. You were sending me
absolutely livid.
And a lot of exclamation marks.
Yeah, very fruity language.
I mean, the first point I want to make before we move on to the certain films that you feel are unfairly included and not included. My point is, and this was the thing that became apparently abundantly clear immediately, was how few films from the last 15 years or even like this century are in that 100 list. And I got my producer, who very kindly went through it and double checked, I think maybe just once,
that's got a nod.
And she counted that there are only 10 films from the last 15 years
10 films from the last 15 years
out of 100.
That's incredible.
Which does slightly back up my theory that we are living in an age that isn't particularly ripe for comedy movies.
I would disagree somewhat in that I think we live in an age where there aren't many critics who know how to review comedy.
Okay, so that's your big gripe with this, okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, there was one critic in particular who is wonderful, but there was a film I love. It wasn't the 40-year-old virgin, it was Knocked Up. Mm-hmm. And at the start of his review, he said something like, any women listening, I would like to apologise on behalf of men everywhere. We are not like this. A lot of comedians feel this way because we work in comedy and we care so passionately about comedy. When it does come down to comedy, we do know what we're talking about, I think, and we do know what is funny. And there's been a lot of really funny movies in the last 15 years that have taken quite a hammering at the box office. Hammering from the critics. They've done well at the box office, but they're the movies that if I want a good laugh, I will sit down and... for example, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, I think will be remembered as a classic comedy. That film still holds up now.
I agree.
Better than a lot of films on this list.
And it's not in the list.
I couldn't find it.
Yeah. No. You know, I'm not as big a fan of the Knocked Up and I actually weirdly quite liked Funny People, but...
I love Funny People.
See, that was one that got...
They totally fudged the ending with... They go a bit Richard Curtis with the rom-com ending. The first half of that movie is tremendous. It's wonderful. And Sandler, in my opinion... And you know I love Sandler. I thought he was, like, troubling the Oscars. I thought he was that wonderful. And then the second half, it goes...
It's just a different film.
It's a totally different movie. Film. I wish they'd seen it through all the way with a film about a comedian and ego. That was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a beautiful film. And then the second half, you're like, oh, no.
Well, I love The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I think that's a brilliant, brilliant, pitch-perfect comedy.
Hilarious. Great storyline. You know,
but it is about a guy trying to get laid. I know you could say it's about more than that, but it's a guy trying to get laid. And there's, you know, men in their 40s who's just smoke pot and not really doing much with their lives. And I don't think critics know how to review 100%. Films like that. You know?
Because
what's it about? They've got nothing
exactly.
to do. Hang on to their review with.
So Dan and I have this list of 100 in front of us. Mine is printed across five pages of A4. I think with a lot of these movies, there are some real chin strokers on here. Call me old fashioned. I like my comedies to make me laugh. I like my comedies to be funny.
Yeah.
Now, number two on this list is Dr. Strangelove. I'm well aware that I would get assassinated for saying anything negative about Stanley Kubrick. I'm not saying it's not a beautifully made film. I watched it relatively recently. It's really well acted. It looks terrific. Was I laughing that much? Not really. and it's number two on the list. Now... This is sacrilege, I'm about to say. If I want to be made to laugh, I would pick Happy Gilmore with my hand to God over Dr. Strangelove. So I'm going Sandler over Kubrick, right? Not many people have said that out loud.
But my
list would be markedly different to this. With comedies, I think you should be laughing out loud.
The issue here is there are a lot of people who are clearly... out of this 250 critics in their 80s and still remember the first time they saw Duck Soup, because I'm sorry, like, look, Duck Soup is a brilliant film, but there's some other films from like the 40s and 50s and you're like, well, are we just sort of, is it a bit rose tinted?
I think it's very rose tinted. If you got those 250 critics in a cinema now and you whacked on, I mean, let's say Broadcast News. I mean, James L. Brooks is, you know, he may well be a genius. It's not that hilarious.
Will it kill the room like Borat would?
No,
that's the thing.
Not.
It just wouldn't. But here's the thing, because like the top ten is, let's just quickly do this. Number one, this is from 1 to 10. Some Like It Hot, Doctor Strangelove, Annie Hall, Groundhog Day, Duck Soup, Life of Brian, Airplane, Playtime, and... This is Spinal Tap and The General. This is Spinal Tap, one of the all-time greats. I'm surprised Airplane's on there when you consider the rest of the list.
I agree.
Because that seems a bit like...
Great to have such a gag-heavy movie in there.
But the thing is I think what's happened is the critics are going, what are well-made movies?
Yes, I agree.
They're not going, what has the funniest moments in it and what makes a whole room laugh? They're going, Annie Hall is an absolutely incredible movie.
It's so clever, the ideas, it's, you know...
Would it make a room of laymen crack up like, I don't know, like
Bridesmaids, for example, which is on the list. So I went to go see Bridesmaids the first night it came out. The cinema was packed. You know, the room was rocking with laughter. And I would seriously question whether most of the films on this list would have that same impact. Now, the critics could argue, but we are picking the greatest comedies. We're not picking the funniest comedies. But I would say, fuck off.
Yeah. I'd like to see that conversation take place. I mean, so that's what I'm thinking here with a lot of these. But then you do have quite high up on the list Python films, you know, Mel Brooks films, which are silly
and very funny
and funny and bawdy. And but, you know,
if I can just drop one name, the one that I've been building up to, and I've
got
the fact that Planes, Trains and Automobiles isn't on this list, because it's a beautiful film.
I can see tears in your eyes.
Oh my God. I want to get in that room with those 250 critics and go, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
It looks great. The script is joyous. The chemistry between the two is terrific. It still holds up now. And crucially, it is very, very, very funny. I've seen that film easily double figures, and it still makes me laugh. And you spot little bits in it. Every time you watch it, like a great work of art, you always notice something different. I love that film with all my heart. And the fact that that's not on this 100, what are these guys smoking?
It's weird that Clueless is in this, because it feels like a very middle-aged white man list of intellectual...
And then they let my wife have a vote. Wow. She loves that movie. She loves that movie.
But it feels like a chin-scratchy movie critic list, like you said. And then there's
something about Mary.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are all great. Most of them, I believe, are all great films. It's just, it is weird that, like you say, so many things have been...
For example, take the Royal Tenenbaums. Again, it's a beautiful film. It looks great. It's classic Wes Anderson. I don't remember laughing too much.
Yeah, I sort of did laugh a bit, but...
Yeah, I laughed a bit. They got a couple of chuckles out of me.
Yeah.
Tops.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, like, even Pulp Fiction, obviously, probably in my top 10 greatest films of all time, but would I...
If I said to you, give me your favourite comedies, and you said Pulp Fiction, I'd go, try again.
It's such a bizarre... I guess this is the thing, is like, when you're... You know, it comes down to the thing that you have a bit of a beef about, which is, how do you review comedy? And it's the same... My producer's going mad that Home Alone isn't in there.
I thought of Home Alone because Home Alone is genuinely funny. We rewatched that at Christmas. Oh my goodness! We're talking funny Christmas movies. Bad Santa.
Oh my god! I love Bad Santa.
So I know these are broad, but a few I've picked out from the last 10-20 years. That's Happy Gilmore is hilarious. Dumb and Dumber isn't on the list. 40-Year-Old Virgin, Planes, Trains, Coming to America. I couldn't see on the list. I could be wrong.
Brilliant.
And then the original Meet the Parents. I know the sequels are bad and they almost damage the original.
But you mean the first?
The first Meet the Parents movie is so funny.
It is actually. I've watched that film since I first saw it when it came out and kind of more critically with a bit of a critical mind on it and gone, no, this is like note perfect. Like the fact that not the bit where we first meet him, but when he first arrives to the house, that it plays out in almost real time for about 25 to 30 minutes, and just how amazing the tension
cranks up the tension.
Oh my god! The camera, the
ashes. It's wonderful. Another Ben Stiller film that I think is hilarious, and I've watched it several times, mm-hmm. is Dodgeball, and all the way through,
couldn't cope with that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really didn't like it.
I think he's so funny in that movie.
I didn't like it. No, sorry. I'm also not big on Sandler.
No, sure.
I mean, I kind of...
He's made a movie with Noah Baumbach.
Yes, which does look amazing.
I do like him in
certain things, but as a sort of... If he had a brand, I'm not coming to it. And then, like,
Whereas I'm wearing the T-shirt.
Whereas you're wearing the T-shirt, you're outside giving flyers.
Yeah.
I'm not into the brand, but there are odd films of his that I really enjoy.
Which ones do you like?
The Wedding Singer, I really liked.
Just perfect.
We mentioned funny people. Name me some others.
The Water Boy?
No. I don't like it when he does the really silly, weird voice. That's the problem I have. I don't buy it.
Sure. Well, Little Nicky was his first proper hiccup.
Yeah.
And that was because he was doing such a... It was so far removed from the brand, if you like.
What else? Like, I'm surprised that The Party is in this, which I love. I mean, if you haven't seen...
It hasn't aged brilliantly.
I'm sure it hasn't, but anyone listening, if you've never seen The Party, Peter Sellers, who is arguably one of the all-time great comedy actors, he's in a film where he says about four words in total, and it's just a man, it's set in the 60s, going around a party, causing trouble.
And that's it, isn't it?
And that's sort of it.
Yeah.
But it's just miraculous that a film like this exists. I think it should be number 23 on the all-time greatest films of... I mean, that's what I don't get. Why is that there? And some of the films we've just mentioned. Tootsie, I adore Tootsie.
I think part of it is I think there's a snobbishness, and I dare say, I think there's an element of that kind of Emperor's New Clothes kind of feeling. And I wonder if in 60, 70 years' time, critics will be looking back and going, oh... Ace Ventura, a classic of its time. You know, perhaps it's just a time thing.
Well, you say that, and that's why at first I was pleased that there weren't really recent films, because I hate it when like a film released last year is on an all-time great list, because it's like, well, maybe we'll think of it differently in a few years. But for there to only be 15 in the last... only be 10 in the last 15 years is... I just think, what is... There's something going on. There's something... I feel like audiences are so wise to everything now in terms of, like, nothing is a shock anymore. Like, after Bridesmaids...
To completely back you up, I rewatched The Hangover recently.
Yeah.
And when I saw that at the cinema, that was proper uproarious comedy.
Yeah.
And then I rewatched it, and maybe it's because I know what's going to happen next. There is no shock value to that film whatsoever. Yeah. And once you take the shock away... Maybe that's the thing. Once you take the shock value away with a lot of these modern comedies... perhaps there's not that much comedy there.
And also, like, it's not just about shots.
I don't really agree with that.
But surprise, you know, like Borat was such a surprise because no one had done a film that was using real life people being duped in a feature film, and he took the shock factor really far. But also, like, Bridesmaid was a bit of a sort of benchmark because it was women doing comedy that previously they weren't kind of given the chance to do, like, you know, like gross out comedy and stuff. James has just had a heart attack.
Falling off my chair.
But do you know what I mean? It's like, now, well, what's left? What are the things that are going to surprise people where they feel like, I've never seen that before? And that's what I think we're struggling with in comedy, in a way that in other genres and other formats, like, we're
I think one problem is that there was a time where improv was the thing. That was very en vogue. So you had all the comedians and actors doing improv, and they thought that that would be enough to see them through. And I think audiences, and I certainly tired of that very quickly when it became apparent that not everyone can do improv. And maybe we're at the stage where we're waiting for, if this is the metal music of the 80s, we're waiting for punk to smash it up. Maybe we're, you know, for grunge to come along. Maybe we're waiting for something new in comedy to,
I think,
you
so
know,
certainly
break through.
Certainly in comedy films anyway.
And before
we wrap up, because we are running out of time, unfortunately, Mel Brooks, obviously loads of films in there. Gene Wilder, just big shout out because I love him. The Pythons, there's loads of Chaplin, and there's some obvious ones. And Rhino, which of course you and I have spoken about in the past, just what an amazing catalogue of work he's got. But what about John Landis? Now, here's a man that has he's got like four of the greatest films of the 80s under his belt.
Yep.
And because of that, I mean, I can only imagine it's because of that thing that happened that he was never given the chance to do. Because he should have, by rights, unless he's a terrible human being and I don't know, he should have been given the comeback he deserves, because he was such an amazing director.
So if you're at a computer, I've got your phone with you, just check out John Landis on IMDb and the run that he had in the 1980s. And then there was the tragic accident that occurred on the Twilight Zone movie where someone lost their life, and his career never recovered.
Yeah.
When he's interviewed, he always comes across as a very charming, gregarious, talkative, hyperactive guy, doesn't he?
I saw him do a Q&A after a screening of The Blues Brothers. But the fact that he did Animal House, Trading Places, Blues Brothers,
American Werewolf in London, it's not a comedy, but it was...
No, but that is a comedy. You know, it's a comedy horror, and it's...
What a movie!
And Coming to America. I mean, that's five. Surely all five of those should be in this list. Anyway, James, got to wrap it up.
Well, very quickly, Trading Places, I was really chuffed to see that on there. I'd put probably my top five comedies ever. I think that's a properly hilarious film.
Okay, so thanks, James. Come back sometime soon, please. We are now going to play the first choice of two songs from our guest today. He is Danny Morgan. He's a brilliant actor and writer. He's got a movie coming out very soon called Double Date. It's screening at the Fright Fest Festival this weekend. I urge you to go and see it, because any independent film that gets made, people have to support it. He's picked two songs. This is the first one from the film Sunshine, and this is Adagio in D.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
What a song. What a song. Well, I say a song, but it's actually a piece of music. Danny, you were just saying during that, we have Danny Morgan in the studio. Hello. You were just saying that you were thinking of writing some lyrics to that.
Yeah. I was going to prepare some sort of operatic lyrics for that song. So I think like all classical music, it can always be improved with a few lyrics.
Some pop lyrics
just about what's going on, what I'm seeing in the street, and that kind of stuff.
I think that would be really difficult to like find some lyrics that actually fit. It'd be like
it just reminds me of whenever I hear that song, it just makes me think of a trailer for a film, like a really overly dramatic trailer. Like when it builds up, you can imagine two people sort of being torn apart and screaming, "Don't leave me!" And it just all rising up, and "I love you!" And people crying, and then everything explodes at the end.
Wow.
I don't know what that film is, but it sounds exciting.
It sounds like the end of Rogue One. Everything just exploded at the end. Well, spoiler!
Oh, God.
Why did you pick that? Do you like the film, or is it just the music? Or
When I saw Sunshine, which is where I first heard that song, but it's been used in a bunch of things. There's been different versions of it, but that was the first one I heard, was in Danny Boyle's Sunshine. And it was one of the only times I've been in the cinema and been genuinely on the edge of my seat. And it's sort of towards the end and everything's falling apart. And what's that Irish actor's name?
Cillian Murphy.
Yeah. He's got the bodysuit on and he's stumbling around the spaceship going, and he's dying. And it's and there's that music in the background. And I was almost stood up. And it was so loud, and I just felt this is like a perfect bit of cinema score.
Yeah,
so dramatic and so bombastic and rousing.
It's kind of what makes that scene. Yeah, in many ways. I'm not sure Cillian Murphy would like the impression you just did of him. By the way, you sounded more like a bit more like what's his name from the Goonies. I love the film Sunshine, and I know some people have a bit of an issue with it.
Yeah, it was kind of underrated, I think.
Yeah,
people liked it, but a lot of people said that the ending was rushed and that he wasn't quite happy, and there was problems in the edit and stuff. But
yeah, it did sort of like it felt like a different take on that, like people lost in space thing, and then at the end when there's this thing running around, it kind of was like, oh, okay, we've seen this before.
Which is the problem with so many films: the thing, the monster.
Yeah.
When you finally meet that thing, the film either goes one or two ways. Yeah. You either go, oh, God, that's just a guy in a rubbery mask.
Yeah.
Which, ironically, is what we've done in our film. but we sort of made a joke of the fact that it looks a little bit low budget.
Don't you think that quite often, we'll get to your film very, very soon.
Okay.
Don't you think that quite often in films that try to subvert a genre, that they end up becoming the very thing they're trying to subvert eventually at some point in the film anyway?
I was just saying that at a dinner party.
Ugh.
No, I'm joking. I think it definitely, that does happen. It's so hard to, because all the genres have been subverted and subverted again, and it's so hard to do anything original, especially with something that's been done so many times, lost in space, trapped in space.
Yeah. I remember with Kick-Ass, there was like, for the first two sort of thirds of the film, it was like, this was a really new, interesting take on the film, and then it just became another superhero film. It's like, for that third act to work, you've still got to just
sort of
conform to all the rules.
Well, because you want people to leave satisfied.
Yeah.
You want people to leave going, oh, that was really good, that was fun, not going, oh, it was just really weird. Yeah. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, what was that ending
about? What was that all about? Yeah. All the monkeys came down. And
well, so you have written and starring in a movie that is a sort of spin on a genre, but it's in a way, it's two genres combined, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about your film, Double Date?
Yeah, well, it's two genres that have never been attempted to be brought together. It's comedy and horror.
I'm not
I know that sounds insane. No one has ever tried this, Dan.
Mm.
It's crazy.
Nobody in the world?
I checked. I went on the internet and it said no.
No.
I just typed in, has anyone done this? And it went, no, mate.
Yeah.
Go for it.
I love that you've set your Siri to a Cockney geezer. No, Dan. No, mate.
No, mate.
Leave
you're golden.
Out.
You're golden. Crack on, son.
Google, which way to the cinema? Just bang a left ear, will you, Dan?
That would be a good sat-nav as well.
Yeah,
bang a left ear, mate. Not that one, you cunt. Danny Dyer.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Someone must have that, right?
Danny
someone.
Dyer on the sat nav.
Yeah, they must have. Yeah.
Oh, you've gone too far, you mug.
You muppet.
You absolute muppet.
Yeah. He could make a lot of money. So you've done this thing that no one ever has done before.
Never been attempted.
You've combined comedy with horror. What came first, the comedy or the horror?
Oh, now we're getting philosophical.
I don't mean in the history of the arts.
I see.
In your not a chicken preparation for this movie. Why don't you actually tell us what the plot is first, and then we have a bit of context.
So Double Date is a film that I've written and we've shot, and it's now in festivals and hopefully getting released towards the end of this year. And it's a comedy horror, roughly and very quickly summed up, two guys, two girls on the worst double date ever. And the central character who I play is called Jim, and he's incredibly nervous around women. Like, he can't talk to women. He's just terrified of it. And so I had this idea, well, what if you had a character like that, but the one night that he manages to conquer that fear is the one night that women are actually trying to kill him.
Okay.
And so I liked that conceit, and I thought, well, that's quite fun.
This isn't based on anything.
This isn't based on anything other than my crippling fear of women.
Okay, well, we'll get to that.
Yeah. Thank God. I really wanted to talk to someone about this.
Good. This is the perfect platform.
Okay,
this
good.
This is a
thanks,
safe space. This is a safe space.
This is a splafe place.
I've gone a bit Ed Miliband now. Do you remember that? I am suddenly tush enough. Yeah, that he lost all his chances there.
Yeah, his mouth stopped working.
So you have your character has a woman that's interested in him. He can't believe his luck, but it turns out that she's actually just trying to kill him.
It turns out the two female characters are serial killer sisters, and the two guys don't know that, and they think they're going to get lucky, and the girls are actually trying to lure them back to kill them as part of this bigger backstory that becomes clear as the film goes on. But basically they're trying to kill these guys, and the guys think they're getting laid. So that's the joke that I managed to drag out for an hour and a half.
And you actually managed to come up with a title that does what it says on the tin without it sounding like an awfully crude does what it says on
I know what you mean. What, like bad husbands
bad moms
something?
Yeah, or whatever.
Naughty granddad.
Yeah. No, it's not. Hey, I like that.
Naughty granddad.
You know you've got your next film there. No, what didn't De Niro do?
Dirty grandpa.
Dirty grandpa. Come on, Bob. What are you doing?
I don't know.
Oh my God.
He's ruining all of our.
I mean, I don't mind that he does all these comedies and stuff, but he's now got to the point where he's now made more bad films than good films.
Yeah, that's right. The turning point was so long ago that you can almost not really remember him being good.
No.
And I didn't see it. I saw the trailer for Dirty Grandpa, and wow. And then the reviews.
I haven't seen it, so I can't say anything.
Let's just presume it's awful.
Well, okay, and that's a positive attitude, isn't it? I hope you encourage that for your own work,
I was talking about Double Date then.
So you came up with this idea. It's not at all based on your real personal life.
Yeah.
And at what point did you pitch the idea? Because it is a myth. I have to say, congratulations.
Thanks, mate.
The film. I've seen the film, thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
But also just in getting a film made that will be in cinemas, you know, like, even if you get into two cinemas in this day and age with an indie film, it's a miraculous thing. So congratulations twofold.
Thank you.
So for people out there who are crazy enough to want to even think about trying to make an independent movie, what was the process? Did someone approach you? Did you pitch, cold pitch? Like, what was the thing?
I mean, it was a long process. I started writing this when I was 8 and I'm 34. No, it feels like that.
The problem is that, you know, that's not actually ridiculous.
I know, it
you
takes know? That long.
I mean, Edgar Wright has just made a film that he said he's had in his head for 16 years or something ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that isn't as preposterous.
Oh, mate, well, I've heard horror stories about people trying to get films made, and it's just been, they call it development hell.
Yeah.
And it can just drag on and on. And I thought I had it bad. I mean, we were developing for about maybe 6 years before we got it shot. I mean, that's from me first sitting down to start writing it to it actually being shot. And then I was going, oh my God, it took 6 years. But then I was talking to people going, I've been trying to make a film for 20 years. Yeah. Shut up. Like, it's great. Just enjoy it.
But at what point does it go from some, you know, admirable that they're still pushing and they haven't given up on the dream to what a pathetic, delusional idiot.
Yeah.
Just let go, mate. Let go. It ain't happening. At what point does it go from that to that? That's
yeah.
the thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's so hard because on the one hand, all you hear is don't give up. And no matter how much rejection you get, just don't give up. And then on the other hand, it's like you should really give up.
You should think about getting
a job. You're 90.
Yeah.
And it's this film is about...
I wonder if there is someone who's like in their 80s or something who has, from when he was like 15, wanted to be a film director, has never made a film but still calls himself a film director.
Yeah, I bet there is. And he's just going,
one of these days I'll prove them all wrong. And then it's over.
It's called Star Wars. Something's been done, mate.
Yeah, that would be a bummer, wouldn't it?
And you go, what's it about, mate? And it's about Jedi. Oh, someone got there, mate. Someone got there.
Oh, man. Well, anyway, sleep well.
I regret nothing.
So anyway, you had the idea. Did you approach a producer?
Yeah. So I had a really rough first draft.
I know the answer to this, but, you know, because I know the producer you work with.
Yeah, but we'll pretend you don't.
Yeah, I'm doing the professional thing.
Yeah, so I met randomly. I woke up one day with a really bad hangover, and I had...
What? Randomly?
No, not randomly.
You had that, drunk there the
was
night
a,
before.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was a reason for that. This isn't a date rape story. Yeah, this isn't going to get really dark.
Okay, good.
So I woke up one day and I had a business card in my wallet that said Matt Wilkinson, film producer. And I had no recollection of meeting this guy at all.
Are you sure this isn't a...
It might be. I've never actually spoken to Matt about it. Yeah, he did hover around my drink a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of grooming in the in showbiz. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so anyway, I found this business card and plucked up the strength a couple of days later to write him an email going, hey, Matt, I don't know if I know you or who you are, but I've written a script and would you like to read it? And then he came back and basically said, yeah, Danny, a double date, and reeled off the entire plot to me. So I was like, oh, we spoke about this. And he said, yeah, for about 2 hours.
Wow.
I know. I mean, what this story is about is that I shouldn't drink as much.
Or that you just have terrible, terrible memory.
Yeah. I've either got Alzheimer's or I'm an alcoholic. This story is not fun.
No. By the way, I think we've offended people of all... we've offended people with Alzheimer's, people that have been date raped. I mean, this is...
the elderly.
The elderly, yeah. I mean, you're doing
all right. How long? Five minutes in?
I wondered what that list was you're ticking off there. I just see all the... Right, okay. Well, to be honest, I don't want to go further down that list.
No, you don't, like those guys? No, I don't.
No,
either.
I like them.
Oh, yeah, me too. I like them. They're all right.
So he obviously thought it was a good idea because he wanted to pursue it, right?
Yeah. So basically he saw enough potential in this first draft. Even though it was a mess, I didn't know how to write. I hadn't written anything before. But I had this idea and wrote it out. And he said, there's something there. I'm going to help you with it. And then spent about a year developing it with me and basically giving me a free crash course in writing, which was amazing. Taught me all about structure and all this stuff. And so then we honed it for a couple of years. Then when we were happy to start showing it to people, Matt optioned it and then started showing it around, trying to raise money. Then another couple of years passed. I'm constantly rewriting. And you go through periods of like, this is so pointless. Why am I bothering with this? Mm-hmm. And I'm not a very patient person. So when Matt would say, we're going to do rewrite number 25 now. And I'd just say, no, I'm not doing that.
Presumably you want to know that, you know, you've done so many rewrites. Is this extra rewrite going to actually get us the film made? I mean, am I doing this for a reason or is it just...
Am I just stuck in a never-ending loop?
Do you just love people rearranging words?
Well, there were times where I thought Matt wasn't a producer. He was just a really lonely man that I'd met in the toilets.
Well, it sounds a bit like that, honestly. And at what point did you meet Ben, the director, and he come on board? Because I know that you guys have done a few things like shorts and stuff together and pilots and things. I just presumed actually he was there quite early on in the process as well.
But actually, no. The whole time, me and Ben Barfoot, the director, we were making these short films, sticking them up on YouTube, and no one was really seeing them, but we were really enjoying just pissing about. Ben would literally just turn up at my flat with a camera and we'd have a vague idea of what we were going to do and then we'd just go off and shoot it. Mm-hmm. And what was amazing is that Ben, originally he was an editor, like that's his day job, and he's a brilliant editor. So he could make something that cost nothing look like it, you know, it was quite a decent quality.
Yeah, yeah.
So we made this thing called Where Did It All Go Ron, which you can find on YouTube. It's about a 30-year-old alcoholic, drug addicted Ron Weasley from the Harry Potter franchise. And
and you've been, art has now imitated life.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So pretty much, actually. Well, that was the thing. We shot it in my flat, and the basic story is that Ron has invited Harry and Hermione to come to his birthday party, but they blow him out, they don't talk to him anymore, and he's really sad. And so he gets drunk by himself, and it was just me drinking vodka in my flat and pretending to be Ron Weasley. And then in the end, he puts his wand in his mouth and blows his brains out. So it was quite dark and twisted, and some people found it very upsetting, but me and Ben thought it was very funny. So we
did. You get like young Harry Potter fans that felt like you were ruining everything for them?
Actually, we didn't, because no one really saw it. No.
So you played Ron Weasley, and you have Georgia Groom in your movie. She is in a relationship with, not Ron Weasley.
No, because he's fictional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But with the actor that played him.
Rupert Grint.
Does she know about these shorts? Have you told her?
Yeah, she does. Well, weirdly, when we met Georgia, sort of auditioned her, we had no idea about her relationship with Rupert. And so she came in for a meeting and she said to Ben, so I looked at some of your shorts and I saw the Ron Weasley one. And Ben was like, oh, okay, cool. And she said, oh, yeah, it's good. And then she said, you know, I'm going out with Rupert Grint. And there was this horrible moment of like, oh God, she's just come here to like slap us.
Oh, I'd love it if that was the case. And she said to her agent, get me an audition because I need to get to those fuckers and I need to tell them that that isn't funny.
Dad,
you cannot do that with the legacy of his work.
Yeah, but luckily,
she hadn't gone to those lengths.
Luckily,
to do
she
that.
Hadn't done that. It wasn't just a massive thing to get back at us. She said she really liked it, and she said, "Oh yeah, me and Rupert were lying in bed last night watching it, and we both laughed. We loved it, and so we thought, okay, she's cool."
You also have in the movie Michael Socker, mm-hmm. Kelly Wenham, who I know. This is an interesting thing I was thinking about the other day. I was like, I can't imagine anyone other than Michael Socker playing that part. He so owns that role.
Yeah.
And yet I know the history of this film, that you'd actually written it for Dan Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then because of scheduling and stuff, he couldn't do it. So yeah. Was that difficult in your head to get your head around someone else playing that role?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, actually, weirdly, originally, the part was written as a sort of cocky, loudmouth northerner, which is what we ended up with in the end with Michael.
Yeah, yeah, right.
This was ages ago, and we thought, we had this idea about Daniel Lawrence Taylor, who's a mutual friend of ours, very funny guy. We thought, well, maybe he could play Alex. And then when we had the idea, we were like, oh, okay, that's cool. And then because I know
sort
Daniel,
going against type,
going totally against type. Yeah. He's such a nice, sweet guy.
Yeah,
but he's also very charming.
Mm-hmm.
So I could get him. To, yeah, he's a bit of a dick, but he's very charming, and I knew I could get him to say quite horrible things, and he's just got like that cheeky smile, and he had to get away with it. So I sort of went back and rewrote the part for Daniel, and then the selfish bastard pulled out about a few weeks before we were started shooting.
It's called the 11th hour, I believe.
The 11th hour, mate. Yeah. Oh my God. But he was absolutely gutted, and we were both, like, we were all gutted because we'd shot a little teaser trailer and everything was set up. We were ready to go, and then he was given his own sitcom for ITV2, which is coming out soon, called Time Wasters, I think.
Yep, yep.
Which he's written and he stars in, so it was a huge thing for him. You know, it was a massive job, and all we were doing was making a little independent film, and he was playing the dick character. It was totally understandable that he'd want to take his own massive opportunity. So Daniel was out, and we had about 3 weeks to find Alex. And now the problem is, because Alex plays my best friend in the film, so we wanted that relationship to be really authentic.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, where are we going to find someone to manifest that in a couple of weeks? We had this brilliant casting director called Anna Kennedy. At first, we were almost looking for a replacement of like a Daniel type 2.
Yeah.
And we went through all black funny men around the age of 30 in the country. And we were just like, I think the only way to do this is to take a complete right turn and take the character somewhere completely different. And Anna suggested Michael Socker. And I didn't, I'd seen him in a couple of things and I liked him in it. He had a very sort of raw, real feel to him. And I'd seen some interviews where he was chatting up the interviewer and I was like, oh, okay, he's got that Jack the Lad thing about him. And he came in for a meeting. He met me, Ben and Matt. And this is now a legendary meeting to us. Nobody else cares. But this was a week before we started shooting, by the way. So we really didn't have much of a choice. It was either going to be Michael or me in a wig, split screen.
I love that I wasn't even called for this part.
Sorry, obviously Dan Clark and then me in a wig.
Yeah, I love that you in a wig would have been a better option than calling me up.
I'm sorry, Dan.
Actually, I would have liked to have seen that film.
Just me and like Eddie Murphy clumps in it. playing all the parts. Danny Morgan and Danny Morgan.
Double date the clumps.
But we were a week, yeah, we had a week to go. Michael comes into this meeting with me, Ben and Matt. He comes in, he's sweating, he's hungover, he's hanging out his ass. He comes into, he probably doesn't like me telling this story, by the way, and I'm sure his agent doesn't. But we're telling it anyway. He came into the meeting. He was like, oh lads, I'm really sorry. Like, I was up last night. I almost completely forgot about this, to be honest. What? So that's not a great thing to say in most meetings.
But surely part of your brain's going, I think we've found our man,
mate,
already.
Mate.
Before he'd even spoken.
He said about three words and we all looked, like, glanced at each other and went, shit, this is him. This is Alex. Because he was just wearing his dirty old white t-shirt. He just walked in and went, oh, yeah, no, I was out. I'm sorry. But anyway, look, I love the script. Like, I love the script. And he started chatting about it and he was really into it. And then about halfway through the meeting, he looks down at his t-shirt and it's inside out. And he goes, oh, for fuck, hold on a minute. And he takes off his t-shirt in the middle of the meeting, turns it the right way round, puts it back on and goes, right, where were we? And just cracks on. I was like, so this is a meeting with three strangers. You've come in. You've taken your shirt off, completely ballsy, just didn't care.
You were just absolutely mesmerised by his abs.
I was staring at his man boobs. I couldn't believe it. We knew straight away.
Yeah.
We were just like, that's Alex.
Before we move on to some other stuff, I thought, the actual tone of the film, I think it's a surprising tone, actually, because I couldn't believe how, like, it's really funny, but it's also really violent.
I know,
as well.
I spoke to you after the screening, and the first thing you went, mate, it's really violent. And you looked, you were a bit white, a bit pale.
I'm a bit
squeamish.
A bit squeamish. But also, like, I wasn't expecting it to. Yeah. Even though, like, I know people involved in the show and in the film, and I'd read the script, so I knew. But I just didn't know you were going to go that real and that violent. And and I think that's great. Like, especially because you start quite dark, and then in come the two goons who don't really know what they're about to get into.
Yeah,
a lot of horror comedies don't always go that sort of aggressive in the horror element of it. There's a sort of, even the horror is a bit funny in a way, but there's bits of this where it's like, oh my god,
it was a definite decision. Me and Ben, we like, our humour is very dark, you know, and we like really violent things, and so we always knew we wanted the two worlds to be total polar opposites. So the guys were very kind of comedy world, and the girls' scenes, we wanted to be really brutal, like really, really brutal, so that, like, exactly like you say, when you cut to the guys, you get a laugh just from that cut.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're going, oh my god, these idiots are literally walking into hell with an erection.
Yeah. Don't. Oh, there's a thought. Wow.
I mean, if I'm going to hell, that's how I'm going.
Yeah, but what if that's then permanent? Okay.
On fire.
This is so strange.
This has got weird. So basically, we knew we wanted, especially Kelly Wenham's character, Kitty. She's the psycho.
Yeah.
She's our Mike Myers. She's our Freddy Krueger in the film. She's our monster.
And you need a good villain. I mean, I was terrified.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I mean, and that scene, I have to say, even though I've just said that the violence is quite real and frightening, and then the comedies, they're kind of like opposites, but the tone does work. It isn't an awkward shift. But one of the moments where the violence is really brutal but also still funny was the big fight sequence with Kelly and Michael, because it's that, like, all comedians would talk about the joke where you just rinse it. You just keep going, and then it stops being funny, and then it carries on, and you're like, and then it becomes funny again because you're like, really, this is still happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be up there with like the Blues Brothers car chase that goes on forever.
Yeah,
this is like a fight that just goes on for like, I mean, it must be about 8 or 9 minutes.
It's probably altogether close to 10 minutes. Yeah. Which in a 90-minute film, you're talking as a ninth of your film is just two people fighting in a room.
So you've got two screenings or one screening coming up at Fright Fest. Is it one or two?
So we've got two screenings this Sunday 27th at Fright Fest, which is in Leicester Square.
In Leicester Square in London. And how can people get tickets for that? Just Google.
So if you go on, if you Google Fright Fest double date, it will take you right to it. There's tickets left for the 4 p.m. screening. Mm-hmm. I think there's about 60 or so tickets left, and we'd really
and
love
to. It's a 60-seater.
It's a 60-seater. It's actually 59.
No, but you're in a big screen, aren't you?
Yeah, one of the screenings which sold out is like a 700-seater IMAX.
That's amazing.
I know.
I wish I was coming to that one.
I know, mate.
I'm coming to the smaller one.
I know. All my friends were like, why aren't we going to that? Yeah. But I think they literally gave it to the to the weekend pass holders.
And if people listening haven't been to Fright Fest, you've got to go. It's a really I'm not even like a massive horror fan, but
have you been before?
I've seen a film at Fright Fest, and it's really fun. The audience really get into it, and there's a cheering and applause, and it's really good fun. I can imagine this going down so well. You've got distribution hopefully in October, November or something.
Yeah, the loose plan at the moment is October 13th on about 80 screens across the country in all the major cities. So
good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
I also want to talk to you quickly because I've never chatted to you about this because you've done a few other films and you've had lots of regular parts in TV shows and stuff, but you were in the film On the Road, which is the adaptation of the Jack Kerouac book. Was it a literal... I've not actually seen it. Was it a literal...
This interview's over.
Okay.
I was told you would watch everything.
I do no research whatsoever. It's my policy.
It's a good policy.
I need to find out in the moment.
Yeah.
No, I am ashamed, but I'm also busy.
It sort of came and went.
Which is a shame, because what an incredible cast.
Oh,
and it does look like it was shot beautifully.
Yeah.
It must have been such an amazing experience.
It was crazy.
Where did you shoot it?
All over the world. I mean, it was mental, because it's set in sort of 40s America.
Yeah.
But obviously that doesn't exist anymore, because there's Starbucks everywhere and stuff, so they need to find places in the world that looked a bit like how America would look back in that day. We were shooting in Mexico, Argentina, San Francisco, which is America.
Isn't it mostly set all up in like Big Sur and San Fran and that sort of area?
Yeah, they move around, but we were literally in the mountains of Argentina at one point.
And was this your first big
film? My first part in a film.
What an introduction. You're flying around the world. You're working with like Kristen Stewart. Viggo Mortensen's in it, right?
Yeah, Viggo Mortensen and Steve Buscemi.
It was mental. Elizabeth Moss, all these amazing actors.
I played her husband, Elizabeth Moss's husband. And I didn't know who she was. I hadn't seen Mad Men yet.
Yeah.
And then I started watching Mad Men.
And you were like, holy
shit. I was like,
shit.
Oh my God, she's amazing. And I've been stood next to her mugging for the past 5 days.
Going, Elizabeth, could you get me a coffee?
Excuse me, darling. Are you a runner? The cast was amazing. And it was one of those things where you just got an audition through in London.
Yeah.
This casting director called Kate Dowd. She's just her in a little room with a camcorder.
And you thought, oh no, it's this Matt Wilkinson thing again.
Yeah.
And I wake up with a hangover and no memory of this.
Matt popped out of a cupboard. Hello. Matt's not a creepy guy, by the way. Painted him as this really creepy date rapist, but he's not that tall.
Yeah, and you presumably think, well, nothing will come of that. And then the next thing you know, you're in...
Absolutely.
All right, and you went to Cannes and
it went to Cannes. It was in competition at Cannes, so I walked down the red carpet in a Prada suit that had just been given to me. I had no idea what I was doing. They took me to Prada and got me measured up for this suit. And I said, excuse me, so when do I bring this back? And they were going, oh no, sir, this is just for you. So I've still got it. So
have you ever worn it again?
Yeah, any opportunity I get, I stick this Prada tux on.
Could have worn it today.
I should have done for the pictures. That would look cool.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing experience.
It was.
Well, listen, let's round off with, we always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure, because obviously we talk a lot about their work and the things that they like and their influences, but we also like to know what is out there that they secretly love. And it won't be a secret for long. Actually, I don't think your one that you've picked is like a really bad guilty pleasure?
No, it's
not. But why
don't
you tell everyone what you've picked?
So my guilty pleasure is the American Pie films.
Yeah.
You're right. It's not a really, really guilty pleasure because I think a lot of people do openly like them.
I think definitely the first one people
yes.
think of as a pretty good
a pretty
comedy
good
movie.
Comedy, yeah. yeah. I think it was... I was about 16 when those films started coming out. And to me, they were just about... having a good time, just being really stupid. And like, I think when gross out comedy is done well,
yeah.
it can be amazing and
yeah,
it can
yeah.
be some of the biggest laughs you'll ever have.
100%. Yeah.
But it you know, it can be done really badly. But, you know, American Pie, when, you know, the famous pie scene, for example,
mm-hmm.
and Eugene Levy coming and talking to him afterwards and just saying, "We'll just tell your mother we ate it all." Like, and he's sat there. And there's a mashed pie next to him.
Yeah.
It's really stupid, obviously, but it's kind of beautifully done. And it's just, if it's performed well, and I don't know. There's something about those films that just reminds me of being 16.
Do you like even the fifth and sixth sequel?
I'm only...
When they started becoming colon something, like
yeah,
American
colon.
Pie on a boat. American Pie.
In space. No, not that. I'm only counting 1 to 3.
Okay.
And even 3, I only really... Oh, no, actually, the reunion,
yeah.
I didn't mind. I was because
okay.
I wanted to see them again. I was like, the guys are back. Stifler's back. I wanted to, you know...
Why are we so fascinated with, like, seeing people age a bit and, like,
yeah.
the nostalgia and...
It is total nostalgia.
Yeah.
It's total nostalgia. Actually, that reminds me... This is going off topic now, but did you see the Trainspotting 2?
I did, yeah.
What did you think? How
We've
did you
had,
feel
I've
about
had
it? You talked about this.
Well, yeah, we had a guest, Richard Gadd, who picked something to do with Trainspotting, so we got talking about it. I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
I adore the first film. It's one of, you know, I think
Me too.
It's a genuinely amazing piece of filmmaking, but the second one I was a bit... it's a bit sort of... It all feels a bit like a... sort of soap
or
I don't know, like just
yeah.
the fact that it became so about
the plot was a little bit hokey.
I don't know, but I still enjoyed it, and maybe
yeah.
it was just because of the nostalgia, and I'm a huge Danny Boyle fan, and
me too, yeah,
and I like all those actors so much, and there were some good bits of it. It's just I don't know, it wasn't
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. For the first half, I was like, oh, I'm quite enjoying this,
yeah.
seeing these guys again. They're a bit older, a bit fatter, they're making jokes about it.
Yeah.
And then towards the end, I just had this horrible emptiness. I was like, I felt, oh my God, we're all... I had this like existential crisis on the way out. I was like, God, we're all just going to get old and die. And now the train spotting guys are like middle-aged and, you know...
Wow,
I felt really sad.
Yeah, it didn't quite have that effect.
Did it not?
I was just a bit like criticising the structure of the movie, but you know.
Maybe I had my own issues going into that one.
Yeah.
But was. Yeah, so anyway, the American Pie films, I still go back and watch them and I'll have a bloody good time, Dan.
Yeah, well, you know, if like there's a history of those sort of Animal House, Porky's.
Yeah.
There's something kind of charming about them,
yeah,
it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
that
like,
makes me sound like a sort of old man. They're quite charming, these
quite
idiotic movies.
I've seen some of these comedies.
No, I mean, yeah. Well, look, thanks for coming in and talking to us.
Oh,
good luck
mate.
With the film. I really hope it goes well. And we're going to play out your second choice of music, which is from a band I'm a massive fan of. So
oh,
I'm
great.
Really, yeah,
me
and,
too.
And I remember reading your script and seeing that in there. And then when I went to the screening, I was like, oh, they actually got the song. Did
yeah.
you have to contact the band?
Yeah, well, luckily I sort of know Scott. Randomly,
really?
Yeah, it's sort of a weird story, but anyway, I had a connection with him, and then I met
this is
him.
Scott from Frightened Rabbit.
Scott from Frightened Rabbit, yeah, and we basically just contacted him, and he said, "Yeah, you can use anything you want,
but it will cost you £2 million."
But it will cost you £2 million,
yeah.
And no, he gave it to us dirt cheap, and that weirdly, like you say, that was the one of the only things that remained the same from the very first draft. Was I was like, that song plays at the
yeah.
end of the film. And Matt and Ben were like, they knew they couldn't touch that. And I was like, that's happening.
I love that. More than the characters.
I didn't give a shit about the characters or the story. Yeah. I was like, this film ends.
Look, if we make
this
a film that's 3 minutes long and it's just that song playing over credits, I'm happy.
I could just be swaying.
Well, it is a brilliant song. I adore this band. I think they're amazing. And he's got such a unique voice and a lyric style. And and I love it when I hear a great song in a film. And this is a brilliant choice. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Danny.
Good luck with them.
Cheers.
Fucking someone to keep yourself free.